verses 1 to 21. Mark 8, 1 to 21. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Seven," they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When they had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present. After he had sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back in the boat, and crossed to the other side. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for 1 loaf they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed this with one another and said, "It's because we have no bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the 7 loaves for 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" And they answered, 7. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Well, we've been talking about the Gospel of Mark, and we're just coming off of this epic feeding miracle, where Jesus feeds 4,000 people with 7 loaves and a few fish. This is powerful in its impact of feeding all of these people with just these meager supplies, that Jesus is able to meet our needs by implication, to satisfy our longings, to make much out of little, to provide against the odds. But powerful also because of its theological impact, which is a lot of what we reflected on last week, that this is the third in a triad of episodes in Gentile territory, and really is intended to show how Gentiles are now included into this kingdom that Jesus is proclaiming. It's not just for Jews. So just as he fed the 5,000 Jews outside of Bethsaida, in Mark chapter 4, now he feeds 4,000 largely Gentiles, maybe 10 miles south along the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Short distance in geography, but this major difference in setting. And so these 3 episodes that took place while Jesus was in Gentile territory built upon each other and were intended to kind of bring us to this culmination. So the first episode was this woman who begs Jesus to drive the demon from her young daughter, and Jesus refuses because of her ethnicity. "First, let the children eat all they want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." Well, it sounds like that's a hard no from Jesus. But she doesn't hang her head or scamper away. She ends up sparring with Jesus' wits. And she is humble but bold in her response. "Okay, I'll be the dog, but doesn't the dog have the right to the crumbs that the children, the Jewish people, keep dropping in their careless reception of Jesus?" She, more than any other person that we have encountered in the Gospel of Mark to this point, gets it, understands who Jesus is. She has, in the words of Isaiah that Jesus quoted earlier in the Gospel, eyes to see and ears to hear, the very things that Jesus says are needed to understand his parables. And here she is, a woman who gets it, totally understands his parable. And because of this, her request, which was initially refused, is granted. Her daughter's made well. And the very things that Isaiah predicted for the kingdom are seen in a Gentile woman with spiritual insight. She is the one who has the ears to hear and the eyes to see. And Isaiah also predicted that the Messiah, when he came, would heal the deaf and the mute. And in the next episode, we see just that. Jesus healing a deaf and mute man. And we saw when we looked at that passage that he uses vocabulary in Mark that is used only one other place in Scripture, Isaiah chapter 35. This very rare word that is found in these two places alone. And so here he is, a deaf and mute man who Jesus is healing, but this is a Gentile. And the anticipated character of the kingdom is being realized outside the boundaries of Israel. Fulfillment among the Gentiles. Ears to hear, spiritually speaking, in the case of the woman who can intelligently dialogue with Jesus, and ears to hear, physically speaking, in this man who quite literally cannot hear or speak until Jesus intervenes. And then the feeding miracle is the climax of these three. First, the woman who begs for Jesus and is told that it's not right to give the children or the children's bread to the dogs. And then the man who was born deaf and mute and is healed by Jesus. And now there's these 4,000 people who are hungry. So with the woman, Jesus tells her that it's not right to give the children's bread to the dogs. First, the children should eat. So all she does is she asks for crumbs, believing that the crumbs are potent enough to do what needs to be done to heal her daughter. But there's still something second class in that, just settling for crumbs. And now there's this hungry crowd, and they need more than crumbs. And we know that Jesus can miraculously feed them because he fed a larger crowd with less two chapters earlier. But there's no reason just for us to assume that he will do something so gracious for the Gentiles. But he does. He takes an epic Jewish miracle and says the Gentiles are entitled to the same. Not just crumbs, they get full loaves. The dogs are now at the table, not just scurrying under the table for crumbs. They eat till they are satisfied, it says. And it's the same satisfaction that is used to describe the 5,000 Jews who earlier experienced Jesus' miraculous healing. And the abundance so full that there are leftovers. And while the number of baskets is less, 7, compared to the 12 of the Jewish miracle, there are two different words that are used for those baskets. In the Jewish setting, in Mark chapter 6, they were these small baskets, kind of like a lunch pail. But in the Gentile miracle, the word that's used is for this large rope basket. It's the same basket that's mentioned in Acts chapter 9, verse 25, used to lower Saul from an opening in the city wall in Damascus so that he could escape from the pursuing Jews who want to take his life. It's large enough to fit a person into. So if we're just talking about the number, the second feeding has less baskets of leftovers than the first. But if we're talking about volume, well, surely the second one is more. Less in number, but more in volume. So all of that. Doors just blown wide open for the Gentiles. And we cannot overstate the radical surprise in this. This is not what they expected. The Jews, they all figured that this was for them. That the Messiah would come for them. And the Jewish underpinnings of this kingdom that Jesus is proclaiming are now being set aside. Gentiles have equal access, equal participation, equal priority, and equal blessing. And now with all of that, Jesus will return to Israel. That Gentile mission is complete. They're welcome, the Gentiles, welcome on equal footing now with the Jews. So Jesus hops in a boat from where he is with the Gentile crowd and sets sail for Dalmanutha, which is a bit of a mystery. It's a location that is never mentioned anywhere else in all of ancient literature. So we really don't know where it is. Many suggest that it's in the region of Magdala, where Mary of Magdala came from. It would be on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. We're not sure. It really doesn't matter much. Just the importance is that they are now back in Jewish Israel. They've crossed the sea from the Gentile area around the Sea of Galilee back into the Jewish area. And he's returning to a place that is the least, or he's returning from a place that is the least likely to find a receptive crowd, where in the Gentile area, they have no messianic expectations. They have no relation to the prophets of Israel. They have no allegiance to Yahweh. I mean, they have no connection to the Jewish law. But there he finds these insightful people who are able to dialogue with him. He finds metaphorical and literal ears to hear. He finds people that are so hungry for his teaching that they stay for 3 days hanging on his words with nothing to eat. And he arrives back in Israel, and the very first thing that we hear is that the Pharisees approach him and demand a sign from heaven. In sharp contrast to what we just left, we should expect the Pharisees to be the ones with insight and spiritually sensitivity. These are people who have committed themselves to knowing God, who study the prophets, who expect a Messiah to come and to bring deliverance for them. So these are the people that we would think would be most receptive. And they come with demands. Demands for a sign from heaven. They're questioning him, not out of open curiosity, but in accusatory argument. They want proof positive that he is who he claims to be. And behind the demand for a sign was this prior firm conviction that Jesus was not sent from God, but that his authority must be demonic from Beelzebub. That's what they accuse him of earlier in the book. And let's be clear, there has not been a dearth of signs in Jesus' ministry. I mean, he heals the sick. He makes the lame walk. He drives out demons. He feeds thousands with just a few loaves. He calms storms. He even raises the dead, not to mention that he teaches with this unique authority and insight. I mean, all the evidence of the power of God working through Jesus is there for them to see. And all these signs, and the Pharisees don't get it. They don't understand. They feel threatened because the very things that they've built their lives on, a legalistic system of tradition that they think brings them God's favor, is being undermined by Jesus. He doesn't follow their traditions. He doesn't submit to their authority. He doesn't soften his criticism. He is shining a spotlight on their hypocrisy, accusing them of setting aside the commands of God for the sake of their traditions. So the signs are there, plenty of them. But the Pharisees refuse to acknowledge them. And now they want a sign at their bidding, because all the other signs, they haven't been adequate. But Jesus doesn't dole out signs on demand. He's not a genie under the control of the one who holds the lantern. And he knows their hearts. If their searching were sincere, then he might accommodate them. But they're testing him. They're putting him on trial. They come hostile, suspicious, accusatory. And their demand for a sign is in contrast to the simple faith that we have seen a handful of times in the gospel. Remember the paralytic who was lowered through the roof on a mat? who's honored for the faith that is shown. Or the woman who is hemorrhaging, who touches his cloak, believing that just by touching, she'll be healed. Or, of course, the Gentile woman who asks for crumbs, believing that those are enough. Each an expression of simple faith that's honored. Each one receives what they're seeking. But not the Pharisees and their demand for a sign. Jesus refuses. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly I tell you, no sign will be given to it." Not at their bidding. Not as a defense of his character. Signs are there for them to see. And more will come, but not for a hostile jury. Not at their bidding. So after their demand, he gets back in the boat and heads across the Sea of Galilee, leaving the Pharisees behind. He's now with his disciples, his loyal followers. And the reality is, they're struggling too. They don't understand who he is. They're having a hard time grasping the signs. After the first feeding miracle, where Jesus feeds the 5,000, the disciples were sent out in a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and the winds kicked up, and Jesus approached them in the darkness. He's walking on the surface of the water, and they were terrified. But when Jesus got in the boat, the winds died down immediately. And then Mark says in Mark chapter 6, they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. If they had just understood the loaves, the feeding of the 5,000, they would not have been frightened in the storm. They would not feel threatened by wind and waves. And they wouldn't feel amazement at the sight of him walking across the surface of the water. They would know who he is and feel security at having this creator of bread and wind and waves as their protector. If this one who can feed 5,000 with just a few loaves is there in their midst, they should know that the miraculous is not out of the realm of possibility. And now there's this second feeding miracle, the feeding of the 4,000. Kingdom opened up to Gentiles, and here they are back in a boat again. And Jesus warns them about the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod. And they hear that, and they think that he's making some obtuse reference to their failure to pack bread for their journey. Because in their abrupt departure, the disciples have not brought bread with them, and they only have one loaf in the boat. The yeast of the Pharisees and Herod, what would that have to do with their lack of bread in the boat? Just because he mentions yeast? They think he's chastising them for their packing? He doesn't need bread. As if that has not been made abundantly clear. As if they've not already seen a sign of that. Feeding miracles have given this unique opportunity for the disciples to learn who Jesus is. To understand the nature of his power and how he uses it. But this makes it clear that the disciples don't get it. When Jesus presses them about their squabbling, reminding them of the two miraculous feedings, they have no trouble remembering the numbers of leftover baskets. They remember the facts perfectly, but they fail to understand the significance of what's taken place. 12 baskets, 7 baskets, and they're still worried about forgetting to bring bread. Jesus has just fed 9,000 people with next to nothing. And the disciples themselves help distribute the food, and they're the ones who gather up the leftovers. They have seen firsthand, even experienced and participated in the miracle. And they're worried about not having enough to fix lunch for 13 of them. So Jesus asks, "Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear?" And by now we can see this theme of eyes and ears that function properly. The parables are for those with eyes and ears to see and hear. The healing of the deaf man just before this is in fulfillment of Isaiah. And Isaiah consistently uses these physical properties of hearing and seeing to refer to spiritual insight. And now he's asking about their eyes and their ears, because they're failing to show any spiritual insight. The numbers are all there. 5 loaves, 7 loaves, 12 baskets, 7 baskets, 5,000, 4,000. They all agree on the numbers, but when it comes to it, the disciples stumble over figuring out this equation. They can't do the math. The Pharisees, they fail to read the signs. But so do the disciples. So Jesus warns them about the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod, which is a curious expression. But again, he's drawing out their reasoning, inviting them to think this through, to have ears and eyes to hear and see. It's like a mini parable, just like the woman who's told about the dogs not being served bread. They'll have to reason this through. Leviticus chapter 2, verse 11 says, "Every grain offering you bring to the Lord must be made without yeast. No yeast in the grain offering," because yeast was a symbol all through the Old Testament of corruption. Of course, you understand, bread was not leavened with packages of Fleischmann's yeast, but with starters. As you bake bread, you would keep a piece of the dough and then just feed it to keep those yeast cultures alive and active. And that yeast would multiply as the starter was fed. And just like a little bit of that dough held back would be enough to keep the yeast going and to spread through a new batch, a whole loaf of bread. So is the danger of the Pharisees and of Herod. And these two seem to have very little in common. The Pharisees are hung up on strict religious duties, and Herod is more concerned with decadent living, the sacred and the secular, which are like these polar opposites. But regardless of the externals, Jesus sees that the same internal rot is present, yeast multiplying through their dough, and the disciples have to be careful or it will invade their own dough, their own loaf. So what is the yeast? Well, both the Pharisees and Herod don't recognize who Jesus is, despite evidence of his identity. Back in chapter 6, Herod would not believe when he heard about Jesus' works. Instead, he hears rumors that this is John the Baptist returned from the dead, which to him feels really ominous because Herod was the one who had John executed. So if he's back, well, he'd be back for revenge. And this is the whole of Herod's concern. No attention given to the idea that Jesus is the rightful king and that Herod should step off his throne and bow before Jesus as Lord. The yeast of unbelief has hardened his heart. And the Pharisees, they want a sign despite the abundance of signs that he has already performed. They've already made up their minds about who Jesus is, and they have hardened their opposition to him. When he healed on the Sabbath, breaking their self-generated rules about working, that's when they began to plot his death. Many chapters before this, they feel threatened by how he's undermining their religious practices, and they're not going to budge on those. They'll hold to their traditions, and they'll kill the Messiah. The yeast of unbelief has hardened their hearts. And that's the danger. That the yeast of unbelief can spread and multiply, and corruption may harden their hearts. The disciples have not been overly perceptive about Jesus' identity. Jesus keeps pointing out their lack of faith. Mark chapter 4, verse 40, he said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They struggle with both of the feedings. They can't see beyond the limits of their meager supplies, 5 loaves, 7 loaves. It's just not enough to feed that crowd. They're not obstinate, but they're also not believing. They're kind of on the edge. Between belief and unbelief, they could go either way, teetering back and forth. And Jesus is warning them not to let that corruption that has hardened the hearts of Herod and the Pharisees to multiply in their own hearts. Not to fall victim to that same insidious unbelief. And Jesus extends this warning, and the disciples are worried about their next meal. Mundane concerns that are distracting them, clouding their vision. They're worried about their packing list and still unable to see who's traveling with them. And I think this is the danger, that oftentimes it is the mundane and ordinary things that tug against our full trust in Jesus, that we are easily distracted, that we are quickly consumed by our calendars and our commitments, the material and the ordinary. So be careful. Be on guard. Watch out. Don't let your convictions be slowly eroded away. Don't let unbelief seep into your life. Cultivate a strong, robust, always attentive, always listening, eyes to see, ears to hear type of faith. Faith is a muscle that has to be exercised. Leave it limp and it'll shrivel up. But keep it active and it'll grow with strength and flexibility. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Screwtape Letters, it's a story of a senior demon who's advising his protege how to trip up his patient. And he says this: "You will find that anything or nothing is sufficient to attract his wandering attention. You no longer need a good book, which he really likes, to keep him from his prayers or his work or his sleep. A column of advertisements in yesterday's paper will do. You can make him do nothing at all for long periods. Nothing is very strong. Strong enough to steal away a man's best years, not in sweet sins, but in dreary flickerings of the mind over it knows not what and it knows not why. Do remember, the only thing that matters is the extent to which you separate the man from the enemy." And of course, the enemy is God. "The extent to which you separate the man from the enemy, it does not matter how small the sins are, provided that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and out into nothing. Murder is no better than cards, if cards can do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, the soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts. The yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod, multiplying in the heart, unbelief, like yeast through a loaf, starting small, but expanding to the whole." Let's pray. So, Lord, help us to be attentive and aware of how that unbelief so easily just infiltrates, and that we get lazy in our faith and we don't keep it robust and strong and vibrant, and it quickly erodes. Help us to see ways in which we may have allowed that to happen even in our current state, and make choices that will change that. Put you first, to incorporate disciplines into our lives that are like exercises for our faith muscle, that we can be strong for you Lord, I pray that as we do that, we would see the results and be encouraged, or that a vibrant faith would be something that really causes us to come alive and to experience all that you intend for us. That we'd see your hand of blessing in it. So it's in Christ's name we pray.